Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week we have a special privilege. I'm talking to former Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, about his book Interventions, A Life in War and Peace. And I've read it. I was present for many of the events. I watched Kofi at work on these. And as always, he's a very modest, quietly spoken person. And I suppose that's a good question to start with. What's it like being a modest, quietly spoken person and having the world's original bully pulpit?
I think you do your best and you get the stories out straight as you can. And I think once you argue and talk to people sincerely and honestly, they hear you, whether you shout or not. And I believe despite that soft voice, I was able to get my messages across.
Well, obviously that comes out. In fact, it's sort of some comparison is your successor, Ban Ki-moon, has similar qualities.
He's
so softly spoken that people people actually, I think, very much to use George Bush's term, another of your heroes, misunderestimated him.
Yeah, which is a mistake.
Yes. Now, I was impressed because at the very first question when he was on the hustings, I asked him about responsibility to protect, and he declared his complete and open support for it.
Fantastic. This emerging norm of responsibility to protect is something that is going to make a difference. I mean, it's difficult to apply. We will run into bumps here and there, but for dictators to know that they can no longer hide behind sovereignty, use it as a shield to brutalize their people, and for the rest of us outside the country concerned to understand that we cannot stand back either, nor can we use sovereignty as the reason not to get involved, not to criticize, not to try to steer things right.
Now, responsibility to protect is a term of art which you helped midwife, isn't it? Because in the old days we called it humanitarian intervention.
Yes, we did. And I think I owe it to the Canadians. There was a very interesting, you may recall my major speech on this to the General Assembly in 1999. I referred to the question of humanitarian intervention, and some of the third world countries, particularly Algeria, had a very strong reaction that it would be a license for the powerful to intervene in smaller countries. Then the Canadians came up with an idea of a commission chaired by Gareth Evans and Mohamed Sanoun, and out of that commission came the name Responsibility to Protect. And in a way, they were clever and more diplomatic than I was, in the sense that it was easier for governments to swallow responsibility to protect than humanitarian intervention.
It was great copywriting. It was public relations.
So we adopted the name. A couple of years after their report, we've been doing quiet work, and we managed to get the members to accept.
I mean, I remember when it first came up was at the time of the Kurds, when Saddam Hussein, and I went into your legal department and they all looked very shifty and shuffled their feet, and they said, well, the only precedent they could find so far was Hitler used it to go in to Czechoslovakia to protect the Sudetenians. So let's not mention this precedent.
No, I think we set our own precedent.
Yeah, but it does show the pitfalls, doesn't it? And in fact, Tony Blair immediately afterwards, despite his, I say, successes in Sierra Leone and Kosovo, actually spoiled it by invoking it over Iraq, which is a war that you said was illegal to your cost.
You're right.
Do you want to expand on that?
No, I think on Iraq, I think some people believe that the council, by not approving the Iraq war, to use President Bush's word, was sending the UN into irrelevancy. But I thought that was one of the best moments of the council, to stand firm and not be bullied. into accepting a war that could not be justified and lacks legitimacy.
You make that point very strongly in the book, and I agree with you, because unless you were here, I think looking at the attenuated state of the United States now in hock to China, you know, running two wars and, you know, basically not sure what to do with itself, those years when basically both Democrats and Republicans picked up the phone and expected the UN to jump.
Absolutely. And also what is unfortunate is you should never use force unless you are certain it's going to improve the situation. Do no harm. You know, you have to analyze the situation to determine, yes, I may win the war, but can I win the peace? What comes after? What do I do the morning after? And I think some of these critical questions were never asked.
Well, that's clear. I mean, you detailed the casualty list in Iraq, the hundreds of thousands of deaths, the complete devastation of an economy, the ruining of international law.
And displacements of millions within and outside the country. And Iraq is still not settled and is going to take some time.
Yes, but that, obviously that's a cautionary tale for Syria, which has been one of your recent cook's tour trips.
Well, I agree with you. I think those who believe there's a military solution for Syria can cause major problems for all of us. There is no military solution in Syria. Further militarization will complicate the situation. And this is why on the 30th of June, I invited the foreign ministers of the permanent members to Geneva. The Secretary of State Clinton was there, Sergei Lavrov of Russia, all of them, and brought them together with the foreign ministers of Qatar, Kuwait, Iraq, and the secretaries generals of UN and the Arab League to discuss a political transition, a political settlement. People talk about Syria as if there are only two groups, the Alawites, that is the Shia, and the Sunni. But there are lots of other minorities, the Christians, the Druze, the Kurds, the Turkmen, the Assyrians. Where do they go? They are caught in the middle. Nobody talks about them or their interests. What we tried to do in Geneva was to propose a roadmap for political settlement that will look after the interests of all these groups, ensure that there will be a government in Syria that would include all of them, a government that will be determined by the people. We start with an interim government. And we went further in that communique of Geneva to say that the interim government will have full executive authority and will try and maintain the security forces so that they maintain law and order and also protect the chemical weapons piles that they have. And all of them agreed, the five permanent members. So once you talk of an interim government with full executive authority, you are really talking of fundamental change, that the government of today is on its way out or has to go to have that. And I had expected them, when they got to New York, to build on it. But on the 17th of July, barely two weeks later, they started fighting again. In fact, there was emphasis on reference to Chapter 7, which the Chinese and the Russians had advised us in Geneva they cannot accept. And in the process, they dropped the substance, which is still, for me, still quite relevant. And I think sooner or later, they will return to this, because unless you come up with a solution that protects the interests of everyone, the fighting will continue. Neither side will accept the dominance of the other. I hope it won't go as long as Beirut did for 15 years. And then we noticed what happened. Each group having influence about this or that territory. And so I would hope those who believe that there is a military solution will rethink. And by the way, I have heard this suggestion that mediation buys time for Assad to do more killing. I mean, this is one of the few situations where I'm hearing supposedly responsible people saying, don't try to seek a peaceful solution. don't give the Syrians hope. And any attempt to mediate is given time to one side or the other. The conflict had existed well over a year before I got involved. If it was that simple, why didn't they stop? They wouldn't have needed me. It's a piece of unmitigated nonsense, but ostensibly serious people and writers go around repeating it.
Well, it's like academic politics. The stakes for them are pretty low. They're not on the ground being shot at by either side.
No, there you make a good point. For the period I was involved, the Syrians and the closer neighbors wanted peaceful solution, but those at safe distance wanted intervention and a military solution.
One of the solutions is almost that the Turks are there, and that if they sort of could do a quick sweep in and tidy up, it might produce a satisfactory solution, since no one suspects them of trying to reestablish the Ottoman Empire just yet.
It wouldn't be that easy, and I don't see the Turks doing it. And if the Turks were to get involved, they will only do it if NATO is with them, and NATO is not really Russian in either.
but a lot of attention is on the role of the Russians and the Chinese and the veto in the Security Council, because one of the points about the responsibility to protect was, of course, the role of the veto, and this always leads to partiality, since, as you point out, through Iraq, their people wanted to wage war against Iraq for violating UN resolutions, but then they would veto any resolution about Israel violating UN resolutions.
That's true, too. But what is interesting is I've had the chance to discuss this issue with the Russians and the Chinese. In fact, I was in Moscow in July, discussing it with Russians at the highest level, including with President Putin. And I think we need to sit and work with the Russians to find a solution, because some of the questions they raise are legitimate. They argue that they are not married to Assad. In effect, they concede Assad will have to go, but they are worried about chaotic breakup of the country. They also believe that Syria, in a way, is sort of their extended backyard, and what happens in Syria will have an impact on their own situation. And they have their own Islamic jihad.
In the near abroad, they call it, of course.
So they are quite worried about this, and they argue that it's easier for US because it's at a distance and has two oceans on either side. But they are part of this landmass and what happens, and therefore they are concerned that whatever change must be peaceful and there should be a continuity. And this is where they are coming from. They also argue that they were deceived on the question of Libya, that they abstained and allowed the process to go forward to protect the people. And that mandate was very quickly turned into regime change. And they are determined to make sure they don't get a repeat in Syria. So if you talk of reference to Chapter 7 or arms embargo, they see it as the beginning of a slippery slope.
Yeah, we should explain that Chapter 7 is the section of the UN Charter which authorizes the use of military force. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I'm talking to Kofi Annan about his book Interventions, A Life in War and Peace. I'd like your opinion on the Russians and Libya, because you and I both know that Sergei Lavrov was the representative at the United Nations right throughout the Iraq War, and he was well aware of what the Americans would do with the resolution if it was given to them. They picked it up and ran, and I've always been very ambivalent about the Libyan situation, because I don't believe that he did not know, and that the Russian Foreign Ministry did not know what was going to happen in Libya when they let that resolution through.
It's difficult to say, but questions that others ask is, what would have happened if the forces that were allied against Gaddafi had bombed the tanks that were heading towards Benghazi? and in a way sent a powerful message to Gaddafi and said, we are not going to let you butcher your own people. And this is a warning. We are prepared and pull back for a while to see what happened. But of course, the argument on the other side is, if you've come to protect us, how can you intervene briefly and leave us at the mercy of Gaddafi? You know,
yeah,
and this was a question and a debate which I'm sure the council did not go through. So your question may be legitimate, but I cannot answer that.
One of the moral dilemmas which you wrestle with, and I'm totally in agreement with you, is on the question of Kosovo.
Yeah.
I mean, the action in Kosovo was illegal. And the way I put it is, so was Rosa Parks sitting on the wrong seat in the bus. There are times when there's a morality beyond the law. And I think this is the argument which you sort of invoked in the Kosovo.
And on top of that, in the situation in Kosovo, we have seen what had happened in Bosnia, in Srebrenica, and we knew what those men like Mladic, Milosevic and others were capable of. And we couldn't sit back and say we didn't know and let it happen.
No, and it's because a lot of people say, oh, this is shocking, sovereignty. And we come back to this basic argument that does sovereignty allow you to kill your own people?
You know, and that's where I made the point that there are times when force can be put to the service of peace, as it were.
Yeah. You're no pacifist. I remember I quoted at the time, and I quoted again, your visit to Iraq, which got you into so much trouble with Madeleine Albright and all of the others who wanted a war, and you were thwarting their plans. But you made the very acute and un-Gandhian statement that diplomacy backed with a credible threat of force does wonders, which was a sort of 21st century version of Theodore Roosevelt talking softly, big stick.
and sometimes threat is in fact much more powerful than when you actually go ahead and use force.
Mm-hmm.
Then you put your ace card down. You have no other pressure point on the people.
Yes, if you rush to force right away, it's you have no cajoling.
Exactly.
If you prepare for it.
But sometimes there's a tendency for people to rush to war. And I came to the peacekeeping department. You were here at the UN. And I don't mention this particular point in my book, with the conventional wisdom that war is too serious a matter to be left to the generals. I left with a different insight after my years in peacekeeping as Secretary General, that declaration of war is too serious a matter to be left to the politicians and the diplomats, because I discovered that all the difficult questions are asked by the generals. Do you know what you're going to do to my boys? What is the end game? Whom am I to kill and why? How do we sustain this effort? Do we know how long it's going to be? All the tough questions come from the military. The politicians and the civilian can stand in the Congress, the Senate, and Parliament with booming voices, hearing themselves and talking themselves into war, sometimes without going through the critical questions.
Well, one of the people who did this, of course, with whom you maintained good relations, and I think for a lot of us it was really sad to see him set up with the alleged evidence, was Colin Powell.
Yes, he is a friend. But of course, you know, sometimes when you are part of a team, it's extremely difficult when the team comes and says, this is the best evidence we have, we are certain, and share it with the world.
Mm-hmm. So he read his brief and with some discomfort. He looked visibly discomforted when I watched him at the time, I remember. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I'm talking to Kofi Annan about his book, Interventions. But that also brings us to, I mean, one of the big problems with the United Nations is that is the United States. you can't live without it, and it's very difficult to live with it. And it was very disturbing to discover that John Bolton, the temporary permanent representative, is an advisor to the Romney foreign policy team.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the most distressing pieces of news I've heard in a fairly distressing few weeks.
Men like him have many lives. But you are right when you look at the history. I think there has hardly been a Secretary General who at one time or the other hasn't had his difficulties with the U.S. And I think U.S. needs the U.N. and the U.N. needs the U.S. But sometimes there is a tendency maybe to forget that the Secretary General is also accountable to the other 100 and today 93 member states.
Well, I noticed with a wry grin that you were reminding Madeleine Albright of this in one of your chapters.
No, I presume it's difficult for them. We are in the States. They are the largest contributor. And sometimes they want to do things that they expect the UN would support. And it rankles when the UN or the Secretary General says, we can't do this. This is maybe in your national interest, but in the collective interest, we cannot support you or act. And in some cases, even try and advise them not to move because it's not even in their national interest.
Well, I remember the famous Robin Cook, the former foreign secretary, was an old friend of mine, and he also told me about, he was told by Madeleine Albright when he said, our lawyers say it was illegal, get new lawyers. It was a robustly American attitude.
But it's very international compared with
someone. Oh, she's not parochial at all, no.
She's a great lady.
In fact, I understand she has a group she meets in Aspen called the Madeleine's Exes, I think, or something like that. They're called
a group of former foreign ministers.
Yes, yes.
Get together and discuss issues of the world, and she stayed very engaged and genuinely interested in what is happening around us. And you would recall when she was here, I think at that time there were only 7 women ambassadors. So she coined the term G7, 7 girls, for the 7 ambassadors here. So they used to laugh and tease when the G7 is trotting off to meet in Paris or St. Petersburg or somewhere. They say, but the G7 is here, the real G7 is here. What are those guys doing?
No matter what the gender of the Secretary of State, it does pose a big problem, is that as Secretary General, I mean, you mentioned the oft-quoted quip about SG standing for scapegoat, not Secretary General. But, I mean, you also have to be a sort of Houdini-like tightrope walker as well most of the time. Because, you know, how do you keep the rest of the world engaged and on side and fend off the beast in Washington at the same time?
No, that is a challenge. The Secretary General must at every time be conscious that he's a Secretary General for the world, not for one region, not for one country, not for the powerful or the weak, but has to make sure the interest of everyone is protected and covered. And that is not easy, particularly when you have powerful countries who want to have their way. So you need to be able to stand up to them and explain to them that it's not even in their interest to want to have their way all the time. And in fact, by doing that, they weaken the organization they want to dominate, and they also lose support from the others. And in fact, they shouldn't place the Secretary General in that situation. If he follows and does the bidding, he's weakened vis-à-vis the others and the rest of the world.
Yeah, clearly. And this comes to weakening. I mean, to what extent do you think it was a direct response to your entirely well-lawyered statement? I'm sure Hans Corell, the Undersecretary General for Legal Affairs, would agree with you that the Iraq War was, in effect, illegal. But many of us thought that this was the genesis of the sort of the witch hunt on oil for food.
No, it's interesting. I had, right from the beginning, made it clear that I was not in favor of the war, that any attempt to go to war without a council sanction will not be in conformity with the charter. So I had explained it many times.
Tactful ways.
Diplomatically, until I use the word illegal. And of course, it really provoked a strong reaction from Washington and the oil for food crisis. Not that the UN did everything right. We made mistakes, was exploited. And particularly when they discovered that my son had worked for one of the companies that got an inspection contract. And I think set up another investigation. Remember, I appointed Volcker to investigate for us. And then the Senate or the Congress also set up an investigation. And they had a rogue investigator planted in the Volcker group, feeding things into, so things that we discussed in private, which were not intended to come out until the whole investigation was completed, would appear
in the press and in the Senate.
Washington in the Senate. And the disappointing thing is that when at the end it became clear that if there was corruption, the real corruption was in the capitals, because it was the companies.
There was the French and the British and the Americans and other companies that were
cutting the deals with Saddam to get contracts. And in fact, when you look at the UNN, the corruption, only one person was alleged to have taken something of money from the, but the rest, the 2,200 companies, were all out there.
Well, the interesting part about this, of course,
and the press lost interest after that.
Yeah, the amount of money involved was next to nothing. There was a huge amount of smoke with a very little spark. But when President Bush appointed an inspector who discovered billions and billions of dollars, including the oil for food surplus, had just disappeared without trace into Iraq, that Fox was silent, News Corp was silent, all of the people who persecuted you maintained a discreet silence about it.
It's extraordinary, but that's the world we live in.
But I mean, I remember at the time, this took a...
It was difficult.
It took a tremendous personal toll on you. I'm sorry it was visible that you were...
No, it was difficult. And in fact, the whole Iraq thing was a nightmare for me. Not only was I against the war with every fiber in my body, but then later on when my friends and colleagues, Sergio and Nadia and others, got killed in Iraq for going there to help the Iraqi people, on top, you know, and my melancholy, my frustration. I mean, most people perhaps wouldn't know how deeply I felt or hit me, except perhaps my wife Nan, who knew to have the accumulation of malaise, if you wish, one after the other. It was tough. And then, of course, when you look at the results. And the Iraq of today, it still pains you.
No, it's not an improvement. Well, that's all we have time for. This has been Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, speaking to Kofi Annan about his book, Interventions, A Life in War and Peace. Thanks very much, Kofi.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really wonderful to see you.
Listen in next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.